Welcome to Warships Pod, and welcome to part two of my discussion with Gary Blackburn and David Blagden. Having talked about UK defence matters, we now look at NATO and also the Ukraine war and the Russian threat. Turning again to the Trump thing and the future, and looking at the events in the Red Sea and also the Black Sea, the Ukraine war, and basically the general Russia versus NATO thing, we seem to be approaching another watershed with the general election here and also the election in the USA, as you've alluded to there, Gary. And do you think that in, let's say, 9 months' time, and it's a big ask, this question, we could be in a whole lot deeper world of hurt if the Americans decide with new President Trump, that's it, as you say, dormant NATO, and then we're suddenly caught, you know, in 2025 with no critical mass, you know, not enough people, you know, the new ships and everything else, whatever it is, Army, Air Force, Navy, are years away. Are we going to be in a whole world of hurt then, do you think?
Well, there are at least two schools of thought on this, I think. There are some people, obviously, who think that if Russia is seen to win in Ukraine, however that winning is defined, let's say it becomes a frozen conflict, let's say Donald Trump insists on that, then they argue that that kind of automatically follows that he will be emboldened by that and might then, you know, seek to take out, I don't know, one of the Baltic states or something like that, or cause, you know, sow division and bring NATO down that way. I don't think that's inevitable or likely myself. I think any Russian victory would be a Pyrrhic one and has come at a fairly gargantuan cost. So I certainly wouldn't think that would be an immediate threat. But having said that, I think the problem with one of the issues with the dormant NATO plan, as I understand it, is that the United States would remove all its land forces from Europe, which potentially might signal to Putin there is an opportunity to cause or precipitate an Article 5 crisis and sow a lot of discord at best. But I don't know. It's a difficult one. But if that happens, if there's a transition between, so I think the basic Trump plan is to hand the baton to the Europeans to look after their own security, which is not a wholly unreasonable proposition. But there's that transition period, a bit like if I extend the metaphor of a relay runner handing over the baton, there is that point, obviously, in a relay race where you could drop the baton. And that is, I think, what people are really fearful about at that point. It's great that Whitehall, you know, and our equivalents in France and Germany and Poland, etc., are clearly thinking about this and increasing budgets, however slowly, as a result. I don't know. I think it's unlikely that we would fall into the worst case scenario, but those people who argue that, I think, have got a point to some extent. And I certainly think if I was a defense planner, I would be, you know, I'd be working very much on worst case scenarios and what I could do to mitigate them, certainly between now and November.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of piggyback on that, it seems there's a few different ways, right, that sort of US disinterest or abandonment or whatever of NATO could come about. You know, there's one of which is that, you know, it plays well with Trump's base to sort of beat on the Euro weenies or sort of, you know, sort of make a flamboyant show of abandoning perceivedly feckless allies. You know, that's one thing. Yeah, another possibility is just that some sort of Taiwan, sort of Western Pacific contingency blows up, and therefore it's not that the Americans abandon Europe as a sort of a matter of spite or punishment or anything like that, but simply they don't have the capacity to do two theatres to a maximum extent all at once. And then another one, you know, that you've seen sort of slightly kicking around with these sort of rumours of, say, Poland or France or whatever, talking about deploying forces sort of unilaterally into Ukraine. to sort of support the Ukrainians, particularly if it looked like the Russians were going to make some sort of breakthrough. You know, if that was to manifest, and, you know, obviously it's just sort of rumors and reports and stuff at the moment, but if that was to manifest, given that the Americans have had a very clear preference for sort of non-escalation and not getting entangled in the war, that could have interesting ramifications for NATO, right? If the US basically said, well, you know, hey, Poland, you got yourself into this. So now that the Russians are retaliating against you, you know, that's really on you. You know, that would have sort of potentially big implications for the coherence of NATO as well.
And what about the Red Sea? How do you think that is going for the Western navies or the Western democracies in trying to maintain the Red Sea as an avenue, you know, a roadway for commerce? It seems, you know, to have slipped from the headlines, and the Americans are being expected to carry the weight of that still. So is that something that's become a bit of a forgotten arena at the moment?
Yes, no. Obviously, the frequency of the Houthi attacks is diminished. It hasn't gone away completely. I read a couple of days ago that the cost of a 40-foot shipping container is 3 times higher than it was this time last year. It's not quite at the peak it reached at the height of the Houthi activity, but it's still very high. And I also read that shipping container costs always get higher in the autumn anyways. Retailers gear up for Christmas and Black Friday and things like that. So inflation could come back, and maybe that's why we're having a July election. It might be one of the reasons behind it. So, but, you know, those other navies that you referenced, they're similar to the Royal Navy. They lack mass. So for them, being on station 24/7, 365 is going to be a challenge. And that really just underlines how important the United States Navy in particular is, just like the British Royal Navy during the 19th century, in terms of maintaining a general peace. We've seen that with air forces as well as navies in the region as regards Israel and Iran. Keeping a lid on that conflict so it doesn't become a major regional conflagration. And it really is, you know, navies and to a lesser extent air forces involved in that policing operation. So I think, you know, I think it'd be deeply, deeply, deeply ironic if President Trump gets elected. And because the other thing that's been mooted recently is either he apparently is going to insist that defense spending in Europe, that the floor is 3%, not 2%. And if that were to come to pass, that would be deeply ironic that it was Donald Trump that eventually got us to 3% rather than something Russia or China did. But I do think it would be prudential of the Europeans, and I include Britain in this, to make sure that we have a bit more material wherewithal, if for no other reason to signal to the Americans that we're not freeloading from now until the end of time. And to be fair to Trump, this is a point that Democrats have made as well. Obama made this point. Robert Gates, Obama's defense secretary, made this point. Biden is much more of an Atlanticist, I think. And he hasn't really made this point particularly strongly. But, you know, the Europeans will want some kind of geopolitical insurance of their own. And I don't think that means necessarily this kind of the Macron all-out strategic autonomy approach, but it does mean investing a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, certainly U.S. leaders since, you know, I know sort of going back to Jimmy Carter and stuff have been making this point about NATO and European free riding. And, you know, there's good sort of theoretical explanations for why, you know, minor powers in allies, you know, sort of do free ride and get away with it. You know, and if you can pull it off, it's a very sweet gig, right? Effectively, sort of Europeans spend their taxes on welfare states, you know, nicer roads and, you know, hospitals or whatever, while effectively getting a direct fiscal subsidy from the US taxpayer via the Department of Defense, because, you know, Americans come and protect Europe and we say, oh, thanks very much, we'll not spend much on defense and we'll have nicer domestic goods that you don't have instead. So it's a nice ruse if you can pull it off to an extent. The difference compared to the Cold War is that back then, you know, balancing the Soviet Union was the United States' principal interest. So irrespective of whether it was feeling charitable towards the Europeans, it sort of needed to prop up NATO if it wanted to not lose the Cold War. Whereas now the Americans' principal threat is not Russia. I mean, Russia is behaving in a way that is very hostile to American interests, but in terms of relative power, China is America's principal competitor. So that's kind of the thing that shifted for the Europeans.
And then beyond the black and white issues, if there are that many, and certain grey issues with warfare itself in Ukraine and events in the Red Sea, I was reading something the other day in The Spectator that said that Russia has actually invested in a fleet of ships. I mean, we've known about these dark fleets for a long time that are taking unrefined oil products to, I believe, China and India. And then they are refining them and then basically exporting them back to Europe. So there's this, the reality being that Europe is still dependent on Russian energy. It just goes in a very roundabout way. And actually, it's raising the cost of it. I think that's what the article said. And but I think this has happened in wars in the past as well. And I remember a very famous incident in the First World War, where Max Horton was in the Baltic, where he was using a submarine to sink German cargo vessels carrying ore from Norway, etc. And the Germans were trying to assassinate him and were trying to hunt him down. And his submarine needed a propeller shaft. And to get the propeller shaft, he went to, I think, somebody in Latvia, then part of the Russian Empire, who then, with links in Germany, then went to a German manufacturer and got the propeller shaft from Germany, which was then shipped back to Latvia or wherever Horton's submarine was operating from at the time, and installed in his submarine so he could carry on sinking vessels allied to Germany that were carrying war materials to Germany. So it was a kind of cyclical thing. Do you think there's a whole lot of that going on today with the oil and other things? Are we looking at a sort of an economy or trade behind a veil between Russia and the West still? I mean, it's a big question, but I wonder what your thoughts are on that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's obviously all these stats about how many sort of British luxury cars are now inexplicably being exported to a bunch of quite minor Central Asian markets, but whether they're actually staying in those small sort of Central Asian autocracies that still have close links with Russia, or whether they are in fact moving onwards to another larger market. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, it really brings home for me is how unhelpful all the sort of idealistic framing of statecraft as, you know, the rules-based liberal order or the good democracies against the nasty autocracies, or all these sort of black and white sort of fairy story approaches to statecraft. You know, sort of places like India and South Africa are democracies. You know, it's just that they have their own interests. You know, they care less about the fact that Ukraine is being chewed up than they do about cheap energy and more secure energy for their populations. And yeah, India is doing a roaring trade out of buying Russian oil products and selling them back on to people who still want oil products at the best available price, which, if it's no longer Russia, then it's India for, you know, a few dollars more, and India is making a nice cut in the middle. So it's yeah, I think this kind of thing has always gone on. There's the point you're making about actual sort of supply to your own enemy via sort of circuitous routes, which has a sort of interesting history. You know, you seeing some of it in debates about sort of the US-China relationship nowadays. You know, however many sort of Chinese microchips are in a sort of an American combat aircraft of various kinds. You know, and conversely, you know, how many kind of Western microchips or whatever might be making their way via sort of Chinese civilian importers onwards to a destination where they don't actually want washing machines. They want the chips that are in the washing machines to put in guidance systems. So, yeah, there's plenty of that going on. And also just this point that, you know, states tend to follow their own interests, you know, so all this, you know, everyone is united against Russian aggression. They simply aren't. You know, the states that are opposed to Russian aggression for a number of reasons are all united on that same page, but a bunch of them just care less about Russian aggression than they do about their own other interests.
Gary, what do you think on all that?
Yeah, I mean, completely agree. I think that The British way in warfare has always been arm your allies and use economic warfare to weaken your opponent. And as regards Russia, I think the arming of the ally and the training of the ally has been textbook and incredibly well executed. The economic warfare policy, sanctions. The problem with it in the current case is obviously our own vulnerability to commodity prices spiking, particularly energy prices, and the effect on that in terms of electricity market has led to very, very high inflation, which, as David said earlier, then has a knock-on effect on things like defense budgets. So as for sanctions busting activities, and none of that is remotely surprising. It's a really big question, this really. It's about basically the grand strategy which is being pursued vis-a-vis Russia. I think, generally speaking, we should or should have gone for much more of an old containment style approach, Cold War containment, Cold War 2.0, which takes us back to the military, you know, and the size of the fleet. We, you know, to pursue that policy, you need a bigger military, you need a bigger fleet, which will cost money. But I would argue it would cost an awful lot less than pursuing some other options, which have been, you know, I don't know, arguably quite expensive to pursue. I'd much rather focus on a containment policy, to be honest, because it's cheaper, if nothing else.
And when you say containment policy, do you mean having Ukraine as a buffer zone, or do you just mean having your forces out, let's say, in the Barents Sea or wherever in the Med,
yeah,
just shadowing them to make sure they don't get up to any nonsense?
Yeah, I think we should be on the front foot in the naval and air domains in particular. Yes, you know, support Ukraine, but really, you know, just wearing down the Russian military machine in all domains, that would then force them to spend more on defence than they'd like to, and we go in on that for a long period of time, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and eventually their economy will keel over, as it did the first time. I'd rather pursue that as a policy than I certainly would rather pursue that as a policy than what David was, you know, mentioned, that the French and the Polish positions, which, you know, it may be slightly exaggerated, but the idea of getting directly involved would be incredibly ruinous. It runs the risk of being incredibly ruinous. So I think that approach, I think, is not really the right one for anybody. The Americans wouldn't be up for it. I don't think British body politic is up for that either, but I think we have to do something. And so that takes us back to, you know, I think the composition of what the fleet will look like in 2030 is pretty healthy, but it doesn't really help us for the next 6 years. So I'd like us to address that, you know, quickly if possible. But I don't know. I guess this debate we're having now, it might not be aired, in, you know, more broadly in the general election, but perhaps it's a shame in a way, because it would be maybe more fruitful than talking about national service.
Do you agree with the containment idea, David?
Yes, I think so. I think it's without sort of going and sitting, you know, sort of putting a flag in any camp, you know, an advocate of sort of NATO and particularly American strategy towards the Russians in Ukraine thus far would say it's worked out pretty well within what the US wanted out of it, i.e., you know, the expensively reconstructed Russian army has been largely immolated. Yes, they're still sustaining good rates of production and stuff, but a lot of that is kind of refurbishing old vehicles and stuff. It isn't the case that you can simply lose a lot of your best and most modern equipment and then it just magically regrows. So they have attrited Russian forces a lot. I mean, obviously the Russians have been sort of making operational proficiency gains even as they've been losing equipment and people. So how it sort of nets out is up for debate. But, you know, in that sense, the Americans have sort of boiled the frog slowly, with kind of incrementally putting more capable weapons into Ukraine, giving the Ukrainians more capable systems without there being a sudden rush, you know, to sort of arm Ukraine in a way that, or give them sort of more advanced capabilities all in one go in a way that might have provoked more of a severe crisis with the Russians. So they've managed to kind of pull off what they wanted of attriting Russia, stopping Russia winning thus far. Obviously, you know, the thing isn't finished yet. Without getting into any of the sort of escalation scenarios that they really feared. Now, obviously, that position makes no one happy, really. The sort of American right thinks they've done far too much. And sort of particularly kind of Eastern European allies think they haven't done anywhere near enough. So in that sense, you know, you might think of that as not a million miles from what they did to the sort of Soviets in Afghanistan, you know, in terms of sort of wearing down Soviet power without a big sort of direct confrontation. I think, you know, the thing that makes it harder today is that you are talking about two sort of anti-US powers, one of which is very well armed, particularly in the nuclear domain, and pretty belligerent in Russia, and one of which is less belligerent, doesn't have such large nuclear forces and things, but is actually a far greater economy than the Soviet Union's ever was. You know, China is so much bigger, has so much more economic depth than any peer competitor the US has had before. And actually, it suits China pretty well for American power to be mired in Eastern Europe, for them to be sending loads of weapons and money to Ukraine. You know, that actually suits China pretty nicely. So, you know, doing the bit that they're doing to kind of prop Russia up. So, yeah, I mean, I sort of absolutely agree with Gary. The problem is that, you know, the thing that you're trying to contain has at least two major heads. It's not that their interests are identical or that's part of some great ideological axis. They're just two powers that have strong reasons to be opposed to the United States. So they have a very strong shared interest and have interest in propping each other up in their using their own respective strengths. And so, yeah, containment is going to be important, but also hard because of quite how much sort of weight there is on the other side of the balance, particularly when you look at Chinese kind of, you know, military outputs and stuff. You know, you look at their defense budget and say, oh, it's not that big compared to the US, but then the amount they get for it because production costs are so low there. And, you know, the rate that they're outbuilding the US, you know, particularly in surface combatants, you know, the amount of VLS tubes they're managing to add to their fleet every year really kind of makes the Soviet Union look like a bit of a pygmy in comparison. So, yeah, tricky in that sense.
Right. Well, I think that's a good place to finish the discussion, which was very good, lots of excellent points, and I would agree that containment hard, but the way to go rather than some kind of leaping into Russia like some kind of Crimean war replayed with all the pain and the sacrifice, and actually much worse because you're risking probably a nuclear exchange at some stage if you're not careful. So I'd agree with you there. So thanks very much for coming on the Warships Pod, and I appreciate you taking the time to give us all those insights.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Please check out the June edition of Warship Sci-Fi magazine for our D-Day 80 special, and it includes looking at history's biggest amphibious assault, the unsung heroes that showed the way to go, battleships in action, and also an iconic cruiser that almost took a king and a prime minister into action. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.